With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Patrick Henningsen talks on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Good afternoon, listeners all around the world. This is indeed the Patrick Henningsen Show, but it's me, Basil Valentine, sitting in for Patrick, who is somewhere over the Atlantic Ocean at the moment, I believe. So great to be with you all. Welcome to the show, wherever you are in the world, 4 p.m. tea time, what we call it in England. Morning in the United States, and of course the absolute dead of night in Australia. Patrick mentioned it just there in his little news piece, Peak Clown World, and if we had a title for today's show, that would be it, Peak Clown World. Just when you think things can't get any more ridiculous, they do. But this first story is a genuine funny another example of the lunacy of the third decade of the 21st century. And this is reported in the erudite British journal, a weekly publication, The Spectator, which tells us today that the British Medical Journal, which is the esteemed peer-reviewed publication of the health professionals in the United Kingdom, is investigating a children's comic, a very popular children's comic, which I used to read and which is still a lot more entertaining and informative than the likes of The Guardian or The Times. It's called The Beano. And many listeners from different parts of the world may be familiar with the character who has adorned its front page, I think, for something like 100 years in his red and black striped sweater, Dennis the Menace. Now, it's not the fact that Dennis the Menace reminds me of Zelensky and vice versa that's the story here. It's the fact that it turns out that the children's comic, which has a very popular website visited by 48 million kids since its launch in 2016, is guilty of pointing children in the direction of the dreaded HFSS foods, which for the uninitiated stands for high in fat, sugar or salt. The Beano is accused of exposing children to HFSS content by acknowledging the existence of the likes of Skittles and the popular baked goods retailer Greggs, purveyors of Cornish pasties, sausage rolls and sandwiches to the great British public. Apparently, today's innocent fun is tomorrow's health crisis. According to the BMJ, there are 125 separate quizzes or fact files that mention chocolate, 143 that feature cakes, and even one that features alcohol. The question in the comics quiz being, how long have humans been making beer for? With an image of a pint being poured. Well, children have to learn about beer sooner or later. And of the 10 food games, 8 revolve around chocolates, cakes, sweets, donuts or fried chicken. How absolutely appalling. Look, I don't know where to begin with this. The idea that the contents of a children's comic should be a subject for the BMJ is, it's beyond parody, isn't it? But that's where we are. I thought listeners would enjoy that Clown World story. Unfortunately, most of the other Clown World stories are much less funny or bizarre. I'm looking at a picture of the dreaded von der Leyen woman holding hands with Zelensky in Kiev before apparently an EU summit in Kiev. Although the Ukraine is not a member of the European Union, it seems that that organization, of which, thank heavens, we are no longer a member in the United Kingdom, has taken itself for some reason to the Ukrainian capital, and the sycophancy demonstrated by this awful woman, von der Leyen, who, let's not forget, just over a year ago was talking about mandatory vaccinations for the people of the European Union, while at the same time her husband is heavily involved with Pfizer, and she ordered, I think, 10 doses per person at a cost of billions. Absolutely dreadful World Economic Forum globalist shill. And the Trump card, as I say, that we have in the United Kingdom. People talk about Brexit, and the headline is in The Guardian is how Brexit is hurting the economy. And I've no doubt it is. But the Trump card is that we are no longer under the jackboot of that creature, who nobody has ever voted for, remember, completely unelected, and her assorted cronies and whoever ends up as her successor. Meanwhile, we have, of course, this, you know, bizarre spectacle of the disgraced former British Prime Minister Boris Johnson doing the rounds in Washington, trying to drum up yet more escalation of the war in Kiev. He wants the British government to send fighter jets to the Ukraine. I'm very pleased to say that up to this point, that request has been rejected. I want to see Boris Johnson in a secure unit for the criminally insane. I sincerely hope I get my wish before he gets his wish, because if he gets his wish, he might kill us all. But if I get my wish, we might be one step closer to peace and sanity. And, of course, all this is going on while Vladimir Putin, of whom I'm not a fan, it seems to be very difficult for some people to understand that because one is opposed to war and is repulsed by Zelensky, that does not automatically make one some kind of cheerleader for the Russian leader. But nevertheless, he is in Volgograd, which, of course, was known 80 years ago as Stalingrad, and he is commemorating the 80th anniversary of the Soviet victory over the Nazis in Stalingrad today, laying a wreath at the eternal flame of the memorial complex for the fallen Red Army soldiers who numbered in their thousands. And of course, the Russians feel that they are fighting, if you like, a long-delayed epilogue to the Second World War in the Ukraine at the moment. Ideologically, many of the Ukrainian fighters were sympathetic to the Nazis, as we know, the Azov battalions openly displaying Nazi symbols. So, you know, I think it's a fair enough comparison. The Russian President Vladimir Putin has compared today's fight against Ukraine and its Western allies to Russia's victory against Nazi Germany. Isn't it bizarre? Because they're both accusing each other of being like the Nazis. I mean, that's the main claim from the so-called West, that Putin is the new Hitler. He must be stopped, otherwise he would invade the rest of Europe, apparently. If you believe that, you'll believe anything. And here is Putin claiming that the so-called allies are, in fact, like the Nazis. Putin said Russia was sure it will be victorious in Ukraine, as it had been 80 years ago. He said Russia was once again confronting Germany, and he criticized Berlin's promise to deliver Leopard 2 tanks to support Ukraine on the battlefield. This, I need hardly remind you, is without doubt the most dangerous situation of our lifetimes, unless you were alive in the Cuban Missile Crisis. But at least at that time, you had a sane and highly intelligent American president who wanted peace in the shape of John F. Kennedy. We now have, unfortunately, a senile moron in the White House, a particularly nasty one at that, and someone whose family have corrupt business interests in that country. So we all need to take a deep breath. We all need to do everything we possibly can to call for peace, to indicate to our governments that we do not want this war. It's completely unnecessary. And if you have a chance to speak to or write to your elected representative, who almost across the board in Western countries seem to be in lockstep with the dictator Zelensky, and ramping us up towards a possible nuclear confrontation, please take that opportunity to tell them that we do not want this war. What we do want, though, is we want to hear from my colleague, Christian James, who's going to be joining us after the break. And then in the second hour, I have a special guest to discuss one of the other subjects that sadly never leaves the news cycle for very long, and where the situation, as in Ukraine in some ways, continues to deteriorate, and that, of course, is in Palestine. I will be joined by Mick Napier of the Scottish Palestine Solidarity Campaign in the second hour at about 5:15. But first, we've got Christian. He's got stories lined up. My name's Basil Valentine, sitting in for Patrick Henningsen on TNT, Today's News Talk. I hope you're enjoying the show, and we'll see you again in 2 minutes.
TNT Radio's Jesse Zurawell.
The latest round of proposed amendments to the international health regulations, which were very concerning for many reasons, one of them being the clause about human dignity was canceled out. What is most concerning to you at this point in time?
In simplistic form, the most concerning nature of it is the secrecy behind it. It is still not available on the WHO website. They've submitted their final report on the proposed amendments to the Director General that would have given him a little bit of time to then notify the 194 member nations of the existence of that final report, which is required, according to the international health regulations, a 4-month advanced notice prior to the yearly World Health Assembly. Last year, they kept the document secret until April 12th. And that is just absolutely not acceptable. Where's the damn document?
Jesse Zurawell on Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Public school is the instituted agency of socialism throughout every community.
The U.S. government has no authority to have any role in education.
We're going to lose our very republic if we don't stop this indoctrination of children in government schools.
What happened to us in China can happen here.
Have one kind of education and then call it equity.
It's about outcomes. It's about trying to force us all to be equal.
I think we're going to have a race civil war in our hands.
We are exposing kids to pornography as early as kindergarten. Parents just don't know.
No, not anymore. Not anymore. Parents need to wake up. They don't have the interests of your child at heart.
Truth and Lies in American Education at SalemNow.com.
With a compelling perspective on global politics, this is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
Welcome back. This is the Patrick Henningsen Show, and this is Basil Valentine sitting in for Patrick Henningsen today, Thursday, the 2nd of February, 2023. Joining me in a moment is our colleague and researcher, Christian James. But first, I just want to bring you up to date with the rolling thunder of the situation in Ukraine. And The Guardian is reporting that Zelensky, in his nightly address, has admitted that the situation in the Donetsk has seen a definite increase in the offensive operations of the occupiers, in other words, the Russians, saying that the situation there has deteriorated from the Ukrainian perspective. Meanwhile, the Russians themselves are planning a major offensive to coincide with the one-year anniversary of the war, with as many as 500,000 men now massed, mobilized in that part of the world. Now, that is a sizable force. So it looks as if, you know, in spite of these promises of tanks and what have you from Sweden, Poland and other countries, the Poles have also been talking about sending fighter jets. Fortunately, the British government, for the time being at least, have resisted such lunacy. We can only hope that the situation improves to the extent that the Ukrainians are forced to sue for peace, and that key principle of the United Nations, self-determination, can come into play in the disputed eastern territories, and the people of those areas can decide their futures for themselves in a peaceful way, which should really have always been the case. Now, joining me, because Patrick is midway over the Atlantic Ocean, is our colleague and researcher, Christian James, who I'm pleased to say I had the opportunity to meet for the first time in person last weekend. Good afternoon, Christian. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. Yourself?
Yes, not bad. This is getting to be a regular thing.
And
and thoroughly enjoyable it is too. Now, we haven't been in touch before the show started, so the floor is yours. So many stories, of course, in the world these days. This clown world, I highlighted the one about the British Medical Journal investigating the Beano, of all things. Have you got funny stories for us, Christian? Is it straight on to the serious stuff?
Funny stories, and there's some serious ones. In all fairness, I've been tagging stories all week and doing a bit of research into each of them as and when I can. This week's been rather busy. But it was fantastic to meet yourself and to catch up again with Patrick and a variety of different speakers that we did the other day. That was it was a great night. And that was a powerful weekend for those people who attended that show. But I guess in terms of your sports and correspondentship, I guess we have to talk about Djokovic over in the Aussie Open doing rather well.
Yes, he's won it, hasn't he?
He has indeed, yes. Apparently Bill Gates actually was at courtside, so you can imagine what was
going
on between those.
That's right, he was, yes. Flew there in his private jet, of course, to lecture people about vaccines and climate change. I wonder what he made of Djokovic's victory. You know, I don't think he's come out with any statement, you know.
No, I don't think so either. I thought it was rather interesting the fact that he was there and saw that directly, and I'm surprised that Djokovic wasn't the one to go, look, I didn't need the vaccines to win this, I'm here to play tennis, as he mentioned a few weeks ago, but actually to make further and hammer home that statement. It was odd that didn't happen, but I guess in order to keep, you know, I guess public appearances what they are, maybe that's why.
Yeah, now speaking of Gates, of course he skipped Davos the other week, but that doesn't mean that Davos skipped him. All sorts of things coming out of there, including, I don't know if you saw it, the brain implants to improve productivity. Did you see that?
I did. So actually, I did make a nice little tag of that. So let me roll down through my notes to where that was. So yeah, there was two particular devices that kind of caught my eye, actually. There was there was a seminar that was conducted there that I think you can actually see online, and it was called Brain Transparency, and it featured new and working technology that allows the scanning of the human brainwave via wearable devices rather than electrodes, that allowed AI-enabled computers to kind of read and interpret a wearer's state of mind, and record those brainwaves to generate something in the external environment. So it could be that they would, you know, you might have a certain thought and it lights up a certain part of the brain. The AI interpretation layer would pick that up, and it may enable something like an artificial arm to grip something or to move something. And I guess you would learn that and it would train that over time. That was really interesting. There was a guy called Igor Chuvdok on Substack who gave a really interesting breakdown of what that kind of technology could be used for, and the kind of subtlety that effectively there you have, there's a layer there of information between the human and an AI and an automated process, effectively. So there could be a rather intriguing two-way possibility of what that future could hold for, you know, I guess we've always thought that technology could be worn, it could be cyber, as in terms of cyborg, effectively. We would have more automation, more technology, more abilities around us. Perhaps there's technology that would allow people to wear exosuits and a kind of a maybe extra limbs was one ideal, or to give a person that was one of the ideas, is to have replacement limbs that are generated and affected by the brain. So if you lose a leg or you lose an arm, possibility of a, you know, a replacement one being able to be controlled as if it is a normal one was certainly on the cards there. But so what you have is what will happen next? These people want to see themselves effectively as gods and as saviors, and I kind of wonder what will this lead to. But I guess the technology is coming. It is like, it is the black mirror that is just around the corner, and I guess we have to prepare ourselves for what that might mean. We have, of course, ChatGPT has obviously made significant progress in the news this past couple of weeks, and I kind of wonder what AI systems are going to be, you know, in the layer in between human and technology. Have you got any thoughts yourself, Basil?
Well, I saw a cartoon which was presented at Davos. Some woman described as a futurologist had made this little thing which featured an individual at work, a female, and as a sort of narrative around her work day, where she was very careful not to think about her co-worker in a romantic or sexual way, because that would alter her brain waves in a way that would come to the attention of her employer. And that what one could expect would be that there would be somebody monitoring your brain waves the whole time you were at work. There'd be some sort of alarm if you got too excited, if you got too aroused, if your concentration wavered and you stopped thinking about the job in hand for too long. All this could be monitored. So the sort of sitting at your desk doing a repetitive task, simply daydreaming, that would be curtailed because the AI would pick up the fact that you weren't concentrating on the job in hand.
I can imagine something like call centers would be greatly affected by technology such as that. I guess office jobs. I was going to say drivers, but ultimately, I guess drivers are one of the things that would
drivers
go out
have
the
to
window.
Concentrate, don't they? I mean, it's interesting in the context of robotization and the looming possibility that so many jobs, manual jobs in particular, will be replaced by robots of some sort, whether manufacturing or retail, all sorts of sectors. That this is effectively the robotization of the human workforce. So whereas, you know, we don't mind robots building cars, building computers, it seems to make sense. They do the same job every time. They can have, you know, unimaginable physical strength, you know, lifting capability, etc. Nevertheless, that doesn't mean that the few remaining human beings in the workplace, in office environments or creative environments, also want, or it is appropriate for them to be turned into cyborgs themselves. You know, I'm sure some listeners remember RoboCop and things like that. You're half man, half machine. Well, that may still sound a bit far-fetched, but this is the thin end of that wedge. I've also seen armies of robot dogs, police robot dogs, these horrible four-legged, 100% robotic creatures which can be armed and which some cities in the world are starting to introduce into dangerous, you know, potentially violent situations. Where it comes to this sort of AI brain implant, the simple answer is no. I don't want it. We don't want it. It's not necessary. It's certainly not desirable. It's anti-human. And I, for one, to quote the late, great Peter Finch in that terrific 1970s film Network, we're not going to take it anymore.
So there was one particular person who also stood out at Davos who gave a talk, and it was a Duke professor called Aniti Fahara. And they were demonstrating technology such as sensors on the ears to monitor the blood brain waves. So a layer of information can then be intercepted, interpreted, and influenced again with AI computations. So there will be no need for implantation. It'll be on the external side. But the one thing that it will do is it will be able to trigger dopamine. So it's wearable tech that gives you pleasure, real-time encouragement, real-time discouragement by how many you get. That will work as a in-between from the exterior. So they said that there's tech companies that are already invested in making that system move forward into the workplace. So you kind of makes you wonder who will be the one in charge of that information when it's available. Because if you have communication between technically your brain, your health waves of any in real time, your, like you said there, your employer could be monitoring you at any time. I saw there was a story that went viral this past week about, I believe she was I think outside of her workplace, that she's a model on OnlyFans. In her workplace, she's an office manager of some kind, and her manager had been thinking impure thoughts of her and had used an AI technology to take pictures of her, basically, and then for those images to be put onto a model and seen and acted in an animated way on his PC. And then he shared some images to a work colleague of that, and then eventually that got around the workplace to his colleague. Who obviously was performing, as it were. So AI is really vastly becoming a part of our lives. And I think perhaps that is the scary part of how much intrusiveness that is going to come with it. We have to learn and adapt to have AI working with us. We kind of have to be prepared for what that might mean. I think the way that we interact with technology, with information online, will vastly change. I think there's a whole new bandwidth of information that's going to be coming to us and going out. We exist now in a way where we have so much information, so much input coming our way, that we barely have enough time to understand and interpret. And, you know, it's up to journalists or news feeds to kind of filter out what that might be. But in the real world application, we are facing a tremendous amount of input coming our way. And I think to filter it is going to be very difficult.
Yeah, I'm looking at a tweet here today about a company called Varnatech, who are engaged in so-called behavioral engineering. Varnatech is a UK, Swedish, Australian startup developing digital health innovations to improve public health. This is all part of the so-called nudge society. Similarly, number 10 has been told to add green taxes to clothes and gadgets to reach net zero. A report by the former Westminster Nudge Unit suggests more government intervention into people's lives to cut their dreaded carbon footprint. Okay, so if we allow it, that is the direction things are going to go in. You're going to be nudged, rewarded, whether directly with dopamine or in terms of some other social credit for reducing your carbon footprint, and you're simply going to be punished if you don't, unless, of course, you can afford otherwise. Key point of this, of course, is nobody's voted for it. Nobody wants it. The whole climate emergency is a total scam. It's all about the control. It's the very antithesis of the natural organic life to which we were all born and which is our birthright. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, I've no wish to be nudged in any direction. I will allow my own intuition to do that. I do not require any external agency, let alone any artificial intelligence, to nudge me. Thank you very much.
Well, and it goes to show that it truly is a direction that we are being forced down to go, isn't it? They want us to meet this level and to meet it head on. I guess we'd better go to the break in just a moment, but I don't know whether
we've got, we've, No, we've got 5 minutes. Please okay. bring up the next story, Christian.
Okay, so the Times put out a story yesterday. So we have in the UK right now, we're having a bit of a crisis in our NHS, as is on the news all the time. And that crisis is there's a lack of doctors, there's a lack of nurses. Of course, they're striking as well. On top of this, it's a kind of double conundrum, and they're striking over their rate of pay because they want their pay to be above the level of inflation, which of course is skyrocketing at the present time. Well, it turns out the government wants to cap the number of people in doctor training. So, which is odd and preposterous in and of itself. So medical school places are to be capped in the UK because currently the government pays around £160,000 towards the cost of each medical student, as well as their own expenditure in terms of training in universities. So universities have been told they must limit the number of people attending medical school this year or risk fines. A move attacked as being extraordinary when the NHS is facing staff shortages. Medical schools have been told they have to curtail offers to be sure that there's no risk of them going over their allotment of how many people can go through the medical school. It says here also there's fewer places than normal for sixth formers and higher college to go towards universities in the medical field. So we're facing this again, there's a weird dichotomy happening. Do we need doctors? Do we want doctors? Yes, we do. We have a shortage. Let's cap them and make sure we don't have enough. Bizarre.
Yeah, totally well, bizarre. It's, you know, typically muddle-headed thinking from the government that are trying to save a few quid. There is a bit of a problem with qualified doctors not wanting to practice medicine because they're fed up of the NHS. You know, sometimes they practice medicine for a few years afterwards, those very stressful in-hospital jobs that all medics do immediately after qualification, often working sort of 60, 70 hours a week. And then gradually life gets a bit easier. You can head off into being a GP where, you know, very sort of genteel existence, if you like. Or alternatively, of course, specialise in some kind of medicine and work your way up the hospital ladder, registrar, consultant, professor and all the rest of it. You know, people always say about medicine that rather like the priesthood, it's a vocation. You know, people feel that they are called to be doctors to help and heal the sick. It isn't simply a job. And one would hope that there are sufficient places for all those who hear that calling. The backbeat to this, of course, is that this may be, because you never know with a Conservative government or not, whether or not they're trying to sneak in some kind of privatisation by the back door, that a shortfall in the number of doctors may be an excuse for privatising training, you know, charging, you know, greater fees. It is a very expensive training. We'll have to wait and see. What we do know is that the nurses were on strike yesterday. Teachers are going on strike. And some people are saying that it may even be the precursor of a general strike involving railway workers, teachers, nursing staff, firefighters, all sorts of public services, civil servants. I saw one wag saying that the number of civil servants outside their building in London was the most that had been at that building since before the pandemic, because of course they all work from home these days. But the hospital doctors and the hospital doctors and nurses certainly can't work from home. And of course the claim is that the so-called inflation busting pay rises will themselves stoke inflation, which I do not believe. What do you think, Patrick? Christian, do you think we might be heading for a general strike in the UK? I mean, certainly.
I can't quite pull off Patrick's accent, but I think that there generally is a push towards a general strike. I think a lot of people have apathy towards the government, and they feel no matter what sector they're in, they can potentially, you know, put the placard out and put some rage out there, as well as those who obviously are doing it for the job itself, and they want to the rightful need to protest for their current position.
Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing is... Go on.
No. I was just going to say, finish my point there, really. That I think you will find there'll be a coalition of lots of different reasons why people want to protest coming together, so, and that will cause more people to be on strike.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing really is the culmination of over 40 years of the weakening of trade unions and subtle and not so subtle revisions to what we used to call the social contract, which was that, you know, if you worked hard and various jobs, you could buy yourself a house and enjoy a certain standard of living. That's what capitalism has always promised. But it seems to be reneging on those promises. It seems that we have a small number of super rich people who, for one reason or another, are able to ensure that governments hostile to their interests are never elected. And then we have millions of people on fixed and salaried incomes who, because of the house price inflation of the last 40 years, will never be able to buy their own home. I mean, I heard recently, anecdotally, that people leaving university now are told that they do not have the required income to buy a house, and that continues throughout their 20s and 30s. The only way you can get on the housing ladder being either help from mummy and daddy or earning a six-figure salary in one of very, very few professions. These, you know, ordinarily waged people will, over the course of their lifetimes, have bought three houses for the landlords to whom they pay rent. So, you know, you apparently, according to the banks, you don't earn enough to buy a house, but you can carry on paying rent till you're 65, and you can have bought somebody else who already has a property portfolio, three more houses. Now, that was never the case 40 or 50 years ago. And that is just one example of how the social contract, the understanding of how society works, the role of government in it, has changed. We're going to a quick break. When we're back, Christian Horner and I will no doubt continue. This is Basil Valentine sitting in for Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk at 16:42 UK time. We'll be right back after the break.
Private jet flying John Kerry, the climate envoy for the United States, gets confronted in Davos about his private jet misadventures.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
Kudos to the Rebel News for running down the big celebrities in Davos. One of them was Secretary John Kerry. Here's what he had to say about his private jet ways.
How can you justify being here when you yourself take private jets? Can you answer that? But you've taken a private jet before... No, but you've taken a private jet before to collect a climate change award. You have done that.
Exclusively. So climate envoy John Kerry now claims to fly commercially exclusively? I think this is the equivalent of asking a four-pack-a-day cigarette smoker, hey, how many packs do you smoke? And their answer is, I quit completely. And it sounds plausible until you realize they quit yesterday. The question is John Kerry going to continue flying private jets? One set of rules for thee, another set for them. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio.
Forget your mobile and what's the worst thing that can happen? You have to find the last payphone in Britain. Forget Valentine's Day, tricky one, but nothing a little charm couldn't solve. Forget that the dishwasher actually works a lot better if you turn it on and it's a few excuses about dodgy wiring. Forget to check the batteries in your smoke alarm, and maybe one night poisonous smoke fumes from a fire will drift silently upstairs and suffocate you or your family. Remember, test them every week. Push the button, not your luck.
Speaking on the issues that impact, this is the Patrick Henningsen Show on TNT Radio.
This is the Patrick Henningsen Show, and this is Basil Valentine sitting in for Patrick, who's travelling today. I'm pleased to say I'm joined by my colleague, our researcher, Christian James, and we've been talking about the state of industrial action here in the UK with a spate of strikes unseen in the last 40 years or so, the latest of which being the Royal Mail, recently privatised, of course, which is now staging a 24-hour strike on the 16th of February. Not that you'd know, because I don't think we've had a delivery here today. We had one yesterday, but we didn't have one the day before. The daily service at a predictable time that the Royal Mail used to provide has long since passed into history. They now deliver my mail any time between 7 o'clock in the morning and the middle of the afternoon, and sometimes they don't deliver it at all. Of course, they now have to compete with all these other courier companies, Evri and DPD and FedEx, of course. But the number of packages in particular sent by post and courier has increased dramatically at the expense of the high street, because everybody orders everything online these days. Online retailers can have unlimited stocks and vast catalogues, whereas the poor high street retailer only has a certain size emporium in which to display his wares. And I noticed in my home city here this week, another major retailer disappeared. The furniture company Heels, a market retailer, closed down. And Currys PC World closing their high street stores. And that follows, of course, the collapse of Debenhams, Miss Selfridge, Topshop, and various others, meaning that, you know, one in every four or five of our high streets premises in our high streets are now shuttered. Theoretically, of course, capitalism means that rents will drop until such time as these places become economic for somebody else to move into and operate. But the nature of the high street is nevertheless changing. There are success stories. I was in another clothes retailer last week, a Spanish-owned giant called Zara, and there were absolutely huge queues to get to the tills. There's stuff flying out of there, enormously popular. They've just got the formula right. So if you want to survive on the high street, you've got to know what you're doing. You've got to get the formula right. Christian, how does your high street look up in the Midlands?
It's very interesting, actually. So I live a stone's throw away from the local DHL and DPD sorting office. And I can tell you, I see double-decker wagons going in there all day and all night. And I can definitely say that they are working all day. In the evening, I see busloads of people just going into there to work and to pick those packages, ready to shift them out. But in terms of the high street here, so I was in Sheffield a few months ago, and I live in Nottingham, I went to Sheffield, and I noticed the only shops that were actually on the Sheffield High Street, because they've all closed and gone to Meadowhall, which is their supersized shopping centre. The actual right. City centre had closed entirely. Everything was shutters. Mm. The only shops that I saw that were open were a Burger King and a Poundland. And I walked through the city centre because I wanted to see what was around. At Nottingham City Centre, it's got a number of independent shops. However, they are dwindling. We have seen like the kind of mainstream shops are the only ones left out now. We are seeing the closure here of House of Fraser, which is a rather big retailer. I mean, John Lewis is actually based here in Nottingham and Peterborough. Their two largest stores are here, and they're struggling. And Alders, that was pretty popular here. That was very similar to Debenhams. They closed a little while back. So we are seeing just the chains surviving.
Yeah.
All tend to be changing into like JD Sports and so on. But there appears to be like a change of the high street, as in the shops that you see are barbers. They are coffee shops, which are very popular, very metropolitan. Many restaurants, many customer service-based roles. But in terms of shops, very, very little. Because you get your selection online, but you kind of want to go out and socialise. So the only place to do that now is these coffee shops. And I saw the Wetherspoons, which is one of the UK's largest pub chains, they're about to close a large number of their pubs. I saw Green King is going to do the same. So the UK's perception to the world is there's pubs everywhere, and there certainly was. There's now a lot less And the big chains are closing majority of their shops as well, their restaurant pubs. So I guess they are the places that we socialize here. They are the places that we get together with our friends and our business colleagues. And they're the places where we go and have events. And as they dwindle and, you know, shrink in number, I think we're going to find ourselves, you know, having to find alternative places to meet.
Yes, of course, Napoleon famously called the British a nation of shopkeepers, and he thought we would be a pushover for an invasion. He never made it, of course, but it's certainly true that the small shops formed the bedrock of British retail trade for decades. Small shops started to disappear about 50 years ago with independent butchers, fishmongers, greengrocers all closing down as food retailing moved into supermarkets. You know, some say that's a good idea, some not. Of course, there's been a bit of a resurgence in the sort of high-end and slow food markets with people looking for organic meats and, you know, high-quality produce. Apart from that, as you say, in a lot of more run-down urban city centres, you go fried chicken shop, minicab office, hairdresser, nail bar, bookmaker, that's betting shop, and then back to the fried chicken place, another takeaway, another hairdresser, another minicab office, right? Am I missing something out? Oh, and the odd convenience store hanging on, selling, you know, alcohol and cigarettes, because, of course, the newspapers have disappeared, as have records. I was in W.H. Smith yesterday. Now, W.H. Smith, for those from outside the UK, started off as a stationer. I mean, there's a sector that's disappeared. In fact, I read yesterday that Paper Chase, which is a stationer selling greetings cards, or so they've gone into administration. They can't find a buyer for the shops. 1,000 people are going to lose their jobs. That's Paper Chase. Sort of fancy greetings cards, things like that. Not the demand for it now. You know, people just don't buy them, you know. Smith's was not only stationery. They sold vast numbers of magazines. It was the place to go and get your glossy magazine for the month. If you're a car enthusiast, hi-fi enthusiast, I used to buy the Cricketer magazine in there. And then, of course, also they sold records in Smith's. You know, it's where you would go on a Saturday morning, or I would go with my 50p to buy a 7-inch single in the 1970s. So tremendously exciting it was too, because they had the charts printed out on the wall, and there were even listening booths. You could ask to listen to a record and then buy it. And of course, both those, the magazine industry has gone through the floorboards. Everybody reads online. The record industry has seen sales totally collapse. It's become a specialist thing. I mean, I know there's been a bit of a resurgence in vinyl sales, but nothing like the volumes that there used to be. So consequently, WH Smith have lost two of their biggest revenue sources. The shops are still largely there. They now incorporate post offices. They still sell magazines and newspapers, but nothing like the numbers that they used to. And the whole thing has started to feel very old-fashioned. I wonder how long they'll be around, you know.
I agree. We've seen also, so W.H. Smith's kind of main competitor was Martin McCall, who, very similar newsagent-type shops. They incorporate large amounts of magazines, and they themselves were also a distributor. So WH Smith are the UK's main distributor for newspapers, and their main distributor also for magazines. So that's correct. Yeah. So Martin McCall's also had about 25% of the UK. They obviously folded in November last year with all their shops closing up. I think a large number of their shops have been bought by the Co-op and by ASDA, and will thus become small shops. But yeah, when you see distribution of, you know, information going out there dwindling as well, those subsidiary companies, you know, those magazine companies, those newspaper companies, the ones who sell their stock to them for them to put out there, are also facing, you know, that crisis too. So there's a whole knock-on effect going back up the supply chain. I mean, we all want to write magazines and newspapers in a way. We all want to be able to touch stuff. But that's gone now, you know, ineffectively.
Yes.
It's sad in a way, because I like physical media, and I like to read a newspaper. I actually like to touch stuff, as opposed to just browsing and just scrolling my thumb up. I think there's something quite intrinsic to hold something and have it mean something. When you talk about digital distribution, take the example of, I guess, of Netflix, of Prime. There are shows on there that are no longer on there because they drop off due to licensing issues. So you can't watch them anymore. They were there last week. They're not here today. Perhaps never be seen again. But with a physical media like a DVD or a Blu-ray or a tape or a VHS beta, you physically have it. You can watch it when you like because you own it.
Yes, exactly. Or a magazine or a book, of course. And it used to be a tremendous thrill getting the latest glossy magazine. You know, I knew the publication dates, when it would be out, what day they'd have it in the shop, you know. It's tremendously exciting to have this shiny magazine with all the pictures and, you know, your favorite writers and what have you in it, you know, and it's all that's gone. I mean, the smartphone, I was saying, has replaced the landline telephone. It's replaced the newspaper. It's replaced the television. For me, I don't have a television. I only watch material that I want to watch and dial up online. It's replaced books in a lot of cases. It's replaced magazines. So all these different things, whereas you might have come home, made a telephone call to a friend with your landline, read your book for half an hour, read your magazine for 20 minutes, watched something on the television for an hour, and used all those four different media. Now it's all in the one place, all just tap-tap on that screen.
Tippy-tap-tap. Oh, man. So here's something I deliberately wanted to find a story to talk about that incorporated our friends down south, the other side of the world, those in Australia and New Zealand, that actually should be of importance to them. So I found a story that went live this past week regards to fluoridation. They were intending to fluoridate all of New Zealand, and it has started already. So the story goes out. It was on stuff.co.nz. NZ, as for those people in the state wise, fluoridization of several Timaru district water supplies in the pipeline. It's going to cost 2.8 million New Zealand dollars, with the intention to have a pipeline going out to fluoridate the country. The General Secretary of Health has advised that it will happen for 30. It will take up to 30 months, but work has begun already to fluoridate the country. Now, of course, in the UK. It's not that well known that the UK, England has areas of fluoridation. Scotland is fluoridated. However, Northern Ireland is not. And they managed to defeat that going through. And I kind of wonder, are there those individuals who are down the other side of the planet who also can, you know, put their foot down on how terrible fluoridization is to water and what it does to the brain?
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely debatable whether fluoride actually strengthens teeth at all anyway. That's number one. The theory is that fluoride makes the enamel on your teeth harder and stronger and prevents decay. That's what the idea is. Whether or not that's the case remains a moot point. But if you simply drink it, it's a poison. And if you drink it in a very obviously very, very weak solution in water, that doesn't have that any benefit for your teeth, real or imagined, whatsoever. None. Nothing. All you're doing is slowly poisoning yourself. Why governments and Chris Whitty in this country are so keen on it, I have absolutely no idea. Some people see dark, hidden motives, that the fluoridation of water is a way of calcifying the pineal gland, that it will actually have a deleterious effect on the function of our brains, and that this is deliberate, that this is a mass poisoning exercise to dumb us all down. I don't know if you've come across that idea, Christian.
I have indeed, yeah. It says that fluoride basically it weakens the blood-brain barrier to allow pathogens from the body to enter the brain. And it's obviously been used for that purpose, for actually in medication, enables some medication to enter the body to, you know, pass the brain, etc. That's actually, there's a couple of Alzheimer's treatments that have fluoridated tablets for that very reason. So it'll be interesting what happens to those people. I mean, there is enough pushback against it that it shouldn't happen, but I don't know. It's, I guess that there was this story back in World War II, of course, they fluoridated many people in Nazi Germany, and that enabled them to be docile. Whether that's not to be true or not as a conspiracy theory, I'm not actually sure the details, but I know I've seen that story come up a number of times.
Time's up, Christian. I hope our New Zealand cousins, and I literally have New Zealand cousins, firmly rejected. I'll see you after the break. This is Basil Valentine sitting in for Patrick Henningsen on today's News Talk.